How you doing? Glad you're here. Glad you listened to this episode. Great conversation with my friend Dan Hannon today. You guys, this dude is the man. And I can't fanboy too much when we're on camera, but he's going to listen to this and he's going to realize how cool I really think he is. But got a lot of stuff to talk about. Make sure you subscribe wherever you're at and follow us on socials at MyFi Podcast. Wherever you're listening, hit the bell, hit the button, hit the plus sign, hit the whatever so that you add us to the library if you're listening on, Apple, Spotify, Google, whatever, YouTube, subscribe. Make sure you do all that. And then listen, we do a few things that I think that you'll enjoy. I do a newsletter every Monday called MyFi Monday. You can go to myfipodcast.com and scroll down a little bit. You can subscribe to the newsletter there. It's just some practical inspiration for creative people, creative organizations, creative leaders. It's super fun. I have a blast doing it. You should go check it out and just subscribe and like it. And if you don't, you can always unsubscribe. But I think you're going to dig it. I think you're going to dig today's episode as well. So let's waste no time and get into it. Yeah. Here we go. My friend Dan Hannon is on the show. And y'all, I've got to open this up a little bit because I wanted to make sure. I try to do this with everybody. Sometimes it's harder to find information on people, but I got some info on Dan Hannon. Dan Hannon's a record producer. If you don't know who he is the freaking dude. My favorite drums of all time ever record, like the sound record that just got me, are the intro to this song Apprehension on the Simple Math album by Manchester Orchestra. Dan produced several records for Manchester Orchestra. He's also worked with Teddy Swims, Paris Jackson, Julian Baker, who just won a load of Grammys with Boy Genius. Ed Sheeran, Kane Brown, the heavy band Issues. He's worked with a ton of people. He just recently moved. He used to live like literally right down the road from me here in North Georgia. He just moved to Muscle Shoals because he's involved in a recording studio there called Ivy Manor at the Shoals with another great friend of ours named Michael Wright. They work with some amazing people out there. They have an artist roster on their within their, I guess, label, music group, the band Lula, OK Kennedy, Dan's son, Eli Hannon, who is also just incredibly talented. All these people are just amazing. Their records are all amazing. And I'm going to put a bunch of links in so you can check out some of the music that they're working on at Ivy Manor at the Shoals. Listen, Dan is that dude. Like, he's just humble. But he's done some incredible things and worked with some incredible people. And we talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about what it means to work in rooms when you're nervous, how to overcome just getting to that next place in your career, some things that inspired him early as a record producer, even how he found out about record production. And so it was really cool conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. So let's jump into this conversation that I had with my friend Dan Hannon. Dan Hannon, how are you, dude?
Lee Baker, I'm great, bro. I'm excited to be talking to you and to be doing a podcast. I've actually not done many podcasts, but I consume. I mean, good gosh, the amount of podcasting I consume is crazy.
Obscene amounts of podcasts.
Yeah, so I'm glad to be a part of producing one finally, doing something productive.
Yeah, dude. Man, it's just good to chat. We were chatting before we hit red and probably could have talked for 2 hours. It's been a while since we got to hang out. You moved. You're over there in Muscle Shoals. How's that? How's Ivy Manor and all that?
Man, it's incredible. I started coming to Muscle Shoals in 2020. My first session here was a month before COVID dropped a bomb on everything. And, our mutual friend, Michael, opened this place and invited me here. And I immediately fell in love with the studio and the idea of this property, which is like a destination recording spot. And there isn't another one in Muscle Shoals where you can go to the studio and you can actually walk upstairs and spend the night and stay for a week or a month.
Nice.
And so that's how we started working here. And so I fell in love with it. And over the course of 2020 to 2023, I started working here a whole lot on a bunch of different projects. And so the place kind of drew me in like a tractor beam. And now I'm a citizen of the community. So I love it.
Nice, dude. I tell people all the time, a lot of people know who you are from doing the incredible Manchester Orchestra records that you did. And one of my favorite things when I first was listening to Simple Math, you get to Apprehension. And I tell you this probably every time I hang out with you. And I tell everybody this, the drums on Apprehension are just fantastic. They're like, if somebody's like, what's your favorite? Like, what do you think is like the best drum sound, most perfect drum sound? It's either the Apprehension intro or something Brendan Benson did.
Dragon Tours or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And, Verses, Pearl Jam Verses, like stuff like that. I have great ones. But I think Apprehension's like that intro is just my favorite, dude. They're some of the best engineered drums I've ever heard.
Well, thank you, man. I don't know how much credit I could actually take for that, except I was responsible for annoying every intern and engineer at Blackbird for those sessions, because that actually was my first time working at Blackbird that album. And they, when I first got there, I took the tour of the studio and we were, talking about setup day. What equipment do you want to bring in and have handy? And I got to the drum room and I started looking through the kits that they had. And I was like, man, I want this kick drum. I want that snare. I want these 15 drums,
Yeah.
So literally I had a parade of interns carrying drums and cases. And I had the owner, John McBride, looking at me sideways, like, what in the world is this guy doing here? But also the thing about the Simple Math record was there were multiple drummers on that album. The original drummer had departed the band after Mean Everything to Nothing. And so there were three different guys. I think it was three. It was Ben Hamala, Tim Vary, and Lynn from Color Revolt. I'm blanking on his last name right now.
I love Color Revolt, bro. That record sounds
They are incredible, man. Tim Vary is the drummer on that one, and we had selected basically the absolute best sounding drums in that building. And that happens to be the only song. Well, I'll go even further than that. Like the only record where I've had people from my past, like guys that I knew 20 years ago or then and haven't talked to forever, where they'll call me up to specifically say, dude, did you record the drums on Apprehension by Manchester Orchestra? One guy called me up and he said, man, I never read the liner notes on albums. I don't care about them at all. And he said, and this Apprehension song came on and the drums sounded so good that I had to look at the liner notes. And he said, and I saw your name. And he's like, is this the same Dan Annan? Because he didn't even know I was producing records. So I got a call from him. And that just, stuff like that is always awesome, because the validation of your work is always a great thing. But that's just an anomaly, man, that those drums turned out so well. The drum part is really cool. Yeah, template is cut off on that. That's just that was a special record for my career, for sure.
Yeah. Did you, I may be getting this wrong, did you do some work with Brendan Benson?
So are you, do you mean Brendan O'Brien?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Brendan Benson. Brendan O'Brien. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Brendan O'Brien.
Brendan Benson, I think is in he plays with Jack White. He's in Raconteurs.
Yeah. I always do that in my mind. And he's a great guitar player. He plays Guilds. I know who Brendan, I'm like, yes. Why do I keep mixing these guys up? Sorry, yeah. Brendan O'Brien. Thank you. I'd have looked like an idiot on my own podcast for the whole half an hour.
No. I do that all the time, dude. Yeah. We're just showing our age is all. That's what's happening.
True story. Absolutely.
No, I actually never got to do any work with Brendan. I've met him several times and I got to meet him and pick his brain. And, I learned a lot from his records for sure. He's a huge influence on my work for sure. but never actually got to work with him.
Yeah, he's a big time drum. I mean, he's another guy that I go when I hear, even on the OK Kennedy record, I go as Dan Hannon drums, like, you know, it, yeah, well, it's the same with Brendan O'Brien. It's the same to me with some, like, some hip hop guy, like you go Dre, like those are Dre drums, you know, whether they're samples or whether they're real, it doesn't matter. Like people who have a signature have a signature. And I mean, I know you do a lot of stuff well, but every time I hear drums, I'm like, freaking Dan Hannon did those drums. When that, was the, what was the song before Dress Better? The big single for OK Kennedy, the first one.
Was it Young, Dumb, Naive?
Yeah. Young, Dumb, Naive. Yeah. Yes. I'm like, oh my God, the production of that whole song is great, but, drums in particular. And man, that seems to have done super well. Her project's blowing up. She's got some huge gigs coming up at the Eastern, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny that it's friends in common of yours and mine that have helped push that career along and put some wind in the sails. One of the first people I played that record for was Sam Tesh.
Oh, nice.
And he connected us with, I'm going to forget Doug's last name while I'm on the spot here. Anyway, a manager who manages Mark Broussard and manages an artist named Sammy Ray and the Friends. And he immediately fell in love with Kennedy and her music. And, you know, we aren't signed with him, but he has done a lot to encourage some of the growth and the progress for Kennedy. And he's who put her on as the support act for the Eastern and Iron City Works in Birmingham for those two dates. And she sells out every show. So Kennedy's going to be in front of her hometown audience, which will also be the biggest audience she's performed for yet.
Yeah. The Eastern is my favorite venue in Atlanta. It's amazing.
Mine too.
It's fantastic.
I saw Jacob Collier there and I saw Snarky Puppy there. And I know Manchester Orchestra did the stuffing there, I believe, this year as well.
For the first time that I remember that it wasn't at the Fox, right? It's been at the Fox
right.
the past few years.
Yeah, they did it at Center Stage for years.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah, yeah.
Over at Vinyl and then moved to the Fox Theater. Yeah, so I was excited to see them do the Eastern. That's really cool.
Yeah, I took my family to see the Struts at the Eastern this summer, and it was just nice. Fantastic. It's such a good venue, man.
Rock and rolls.
Yeah, dude. So I'll be excited for Kennedy getting in there. What was the first record you ever did as a producer? Do you remember?
Yes. Actually, the first full record I did was for a band called Pause for Effect. And they were a band that had toured a lot with my band, opening up for us, and we traded shows a lot. And that was at a time where I had stopped touring and I decided I wanted to be a producer. And I literally had to beg people to work with me. You know, and I was like, I did a lot of work for free. At the time, I was working in my 3-bedroom apartment in Roswell, Roswell, Georgia. And I had one of the bedrooms. I had two kids, you know, they were infants. So it was a pretty hilarious setup. But, you know, I had a Pro Tools Digio 1. Which was the most consumer version of Pro Tools you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
I had Oralex on my walls in this third little bedroom. The closet was a vocal booth. And I had one microphone and one mic pre and two speakers, man. And it was me just hustling to try to get some experience and get some songs to put on my producer reel so I could keep getting work.
Yeah.
And they were good for, they're still good friends. Actually, I still remain connected to those guys, but yeah, that was the first record I did. And I believe that was 2003. So 21 years ago now.
Golly, man. That's amazing. Were any of those guys Cause I saw your band, the guys from Manchester did like a benefit thing when you were going through your cancer battle. And I saw your band, that night. Were any of the guys from that band there? Were they hanging out or did they jam that night?
Yes, they did actually. The former lead singer of that band, a fellow named Brent McDonald's, a good buddy of mine. And he was there and he performed. He actually sang on stage with my band when I played guitar. And clearly I wasn't singing anymore. But so he sat in and sang along with a couple other guys.
Yeah, that name sounded familiar. The band name sounded familiar. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that was them. Man, have you ever... Because I've found myself as a creative person in these situations. Because you've worked with Kane Brown, Paris Jackson, Ed Sheeran, Manchester Orchestra, all these incredible people. Producers are not like to the consumer of music. Most of the time, they don't know the producer unless the producer becomes an artist. You know what I'm saying? But like most of the time, right. You know, the general public is not as familiar with producers. But you've worked with all these people. Did you ever find yourself in a room where you were just like, oh, dang, this is like felt out of your league a little bit? Not that you should, but I think as a creative, I've definitely felt that way. Like as a guitar player where I'm like, dude, I'm about to fake it till I make it up in here because I want to be here. And I feel like that's how you get better, you know, is getting in those rooms. But you've from the get go, I feel like you've been working with all these amazing people and been surrounded by all these amazing people. Have you ever been on a session and who was it with that you ever felt that way?
You're kind of talking about imposter syndrome a little bit, right?
Yeah, yes. A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's almost the story of my career, man. I mean, in a lot of ways, early on I definitely had adopted a persona of false bravado just because I had to sort of be the guy in charge, quote unquote, as the producer on these sessions. But yeah, there's been so many times where I just felt like I didn't belong there and like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be exposed. And you know, what am I doing? I have no clue. That's a battle all by itself, but being in the room with Joe Ciccarelli, who I don't know how many Grammys he has now, but at the time I worked with him, he had 8. And I was super excited to work with him. But at the same time, you know, it was like, here's a guy that's really been doing it. His resume is insane. One of his first gigs was Frank Zappa, you know? Yeah. So I'm thinking, oh my God, and he actually came to Atlanta to my basement studio is where we first worked together. So that was one of those moments. And then there's obviously, being in the room with artists that are just iconic, you know, whether it's, I got to meet and hang out with Jason Isbell or, Teddy Swims was another one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, man, there's so many examples of that where you just feel inadequate, you know, even though I've spent my whole life preparing for these moments, you know, I'm wanting to be among the greats, but it's still very humbling every time, you know, where you're like, wow, I don't even know why I'm here or how I got in here. But yeah, I think what's ironic is when you get the opportunity to work with people like that, it's typically the most, chill sessions, the easiest work you'll ever do because you're working with a consummate professional who's been through all of the stuff. So they're the easiest people to work with, you know, it's kind of a paradox in a way because you prepare all these years and you think, oh my God, something they're doing is so different than what everybody else does.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what that secret is, but then you get in there and you find that, no, it's the same process for for everybody, there's just a lot of people who've put in a lot more time or they've had different breaks. But yeah, to answer the short answer to the question is, I still feel that way in a lot of situations. I'm working with a guy named Gary Nichols right now who has become a close friend, but every time he picks up a guitar and starts singing, I just wonder how I was so audacious to pick up a guitar and try to sing something in the first place.
Yeah, dude. He's got a great voice. He was Steel Drivers? Wasn't that the band?
Yes. Yeah, he was in Steel Drivers and won a Grammy with them.
Yeah.
But he started out as a solo artist. He was signed to Mercury back in the day. And you know, he's at a... He's on a redemption story right now. He's had a hard road, but what an incredible artist and a beautiful person, man.
Yeah, man.
I love being in his orbit.
The whole artist roster that you guys have seems really awesome and eclectic. And there's a culture that it seems like just from, you know, what I, you know, I've been a terrible friend. I need to hit Mike up soon. And we don't talk as much as I wish we did. But just watching from afar and talking to you guys when I can, and talking to having Kennedy on the show like a year ago and, you know, just seeing everything. You guys just have
like a year ago.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, her single's been out over a year, that first single, because it was around the Young, Dumb, and Naive single that she
came on. Right. Oh, my gosh.
But you guys just seem to have such a cool culture. It's super family-like. It's super supportive. And I think that's a breeding ground for great creativity. When I run into situations like I asked you about, which I'm with you. I've been playing music for longer than I can remember. And I still go into every scenario thinking I'm the biggest idiot in the room and that everybody knows things that I don't know. And why am I here? And then I get it. You get in there and you go, no, everybody's still figuring... Everybody's still like trying to do the same thing, and getting to a place where you care more about making something great than what someone else in the room thinks about you is key for like you making the best stuff. You know what I'm saying? And you guys have created that environment, I feel like, which is why the OK Kennedy stuff and all the other stuff you guys are doing, the band Lula stuff, all that stuff seems to come out so great. Has that always been something that you've tried to do on projects? Is just create like that vibe that you guys seem to have there, because it seems to follow you a little bit too. At least that's been watching from afar. That's been my experience. Is that something that you just got to have on a session to make it work?
Man, that's a fantastic question. I think it's a thing I've kind of struggled with over the years, because my personality tends to be, you know, I'm very social, and I love having people around, and that fuels my sort of energy, and that's not necessarily copacetic in a studio environment where there's people, you know, lots of people or friends or people talking. But I'm able to work and thrive in an environment that's, you know, if somebody wants to bring people in the studio and hang out on the couch and people talk, and I can still focus and work. And I think it's based, at least in part, in being able to get immediate feedback and the reactions of people that haven't heard this stuff before, and just kind of that encouragement that we're doing something that's connecting on a visceral level, even in a small group of people. I think that might be the genesis of what you're talking about, the culture, which has grown into a situation where I like to feel like these people are my family. You know, I like to develop relationships beyond just the work. It's important to me, and it also informs what kind of art we're creating together. So, over the years, you know, I've developed friendships, and I've had, for instance, right now, you mentioned the band Lula. That's a perfect example where the story of that band is my wife worked with a girl at a Gainesville Heart Group in Gainesville, Georgia. She was a nurse practitioner there. And one of the girls she worked with knew I was in the music business. And she said, hey, there's this kid at our church who's a worship leader, but we just think he's anointed. He just said, you know, he's just amazing. We love his voice. Would you be willing to meet with him? You know, he's 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, sure. I love that. And I'd love to meet this person. And so that was Malachi, who's one half of Band Lula. So Malachi came to the studio back in Buford, Georgia, and we ended up doing a worship song together, which, because at the time he was very focused on being a worship leader and he felt called to do that. He also had a band that was like a soul rock kind of band that was a secular thing. And at the time, you know Jared Prashibish, and I met him around the same time I met you, actually. It was about 8 years ago. And Jared was 17 or 18 when I met him, and he was graduating high school. And he chose to intern and study with me at my studio over going to MTSU to do engineering and recording. Mm. And so at that time, Malachi's band didn't have enough really to do a record, with me producing and have, the full experience. So we basically made a deal where Jared would be the lead. So Jared could get experience and Jared could come to me with any questions. I could help him. And that's how he developed a relationship with Malachi. And he became Malachi's go-to for several projects he's done over the past 7 years. And then when Malachi and Logan teamed up to form Band Lula, they knew we had been working here a bunch at Ivy Manor. So Jared talked them into coming down here and doing some stuff. And when we heard them, then Gary Nichols was singing around and Gary got involved. And so now it's turned into a thing where Jared and Gary made some incredible masters for Band Lula. And they drew the attention of Universal Music Publishing. And this VP at Universal Music Publishing came out to see Band Lula. And then Jared came to me and said, hey, could you talk to Malachi and Logan about how to navigate this Universal Music thing?
Yeah.
And so we hung out and talked about how they should approach that, kind of strategize the way to respond. And, and now they're signed to Universal Music Group and they're negotiating with major record labels for their first deal.
Nice.
And Jared and Gary are, doing the masters and stuff. So, and what's even funnier is their management was here. They just played last weekend. Their management came from Nashville down here. And now they're looking at property in Muscle Shoals. So the community around here, there's an energy like that that's really, really inspiring. And I think that's part of what drew me here is there's a really cool artistic thing spinning back up that's, you can attribute it to that original magic from decades ago.
Yeah.
When all those hits were made. But it's just got a different thing now. It's not, for a lot of years, people have been trying to, in a nostalgic fashion, trying to recreate that thing of the 60s and 70s. But there's a really new thing, like OK Kennedy was done here.
Yeah.
Band Lula and my son Eli Hannon is now making his record here and building a fan base here. And there's just a great appreciation for art and especially music in this area. So
that's amazing, dude.
I think my phone rang and I lost you for a second. Can you still see me there?
Yeah. I got you. I got you good.
Okay. Sorry about that.
It happens. Man, that's all amazing. That's exactly what I was asking. There's a natural, like community, friendship, family, whatever you want to call it, that I think is almost necessary to like get, and not that you have to be friends with everybody. I get that it doesn't work that way, but like, man, it's a lot better if you can be, you know? And when I feel like I'm in a room with people who are, you know, at least like a good hang, my walls are way down as a songwriter, as a guitar player. I'm going to go for some stuff rather than playing it safe. Cause I'm, you know, it's tense or whatever. And I think that translates like to, you know, any kind of creative environment, whether you're like a graphic designer or, you know, an engineer or a painter, an author, like whatever, if you're collaborating on something, it's like super necessary to that. I want to ask you, like, what was your inspiration to get into production in the first place? Like, I know you went like, hey, I want to get off the road. I want to get off the road and I want to, you know, produce a little bit. And so you started working with that band in 03. But were there people and records like back in the day that you heard that you, because as a kid, like I listened to records, like I just wanted to freaking play guitar. And then I started like going, well, that's a cool sound and that's a cool sound. And I didn't understand what, you know, you see producer when you're a teenager on a record. I didn't freaking know what that was, you know? But were there records or moments or producers themselves maybe? And there was just this thing in your mind that went, hey, I want to do that.
Yeah. There was a very pivotal turning point moment for me. And I was very much the same. I was never a kid who was into liner notes and, you know, any of that stuff. What primarily drew me to records was the vocal. You know, they're like, I hate to say it, but I couldn't listen much to Bob Dylan records or even the Stones in some cases, because something about the vocal didn't do it for me. But then I found stuff like Sam Cooke or, you know, Bob Seger was a big one. Basically, my dad turned me onto those records, which a lot of those big hits were cut here in Muscle Shoals. And I didn't realize that until very recently, actually. And I've been a fan of Bob Seger my whole life.
Oh, wow.
But I didn't know the story. But so just like you, you know, I was in a band for 10 years touring. We made our own records. But even through most of my band's career, I had no idea what a producer was, you know, and you got to remember this was before the internet, before cell phones, before YouTube, before MP3s, you know, so you had to really be focused on finding out information. You got to go to the library, you got to go to the bookstore, you got to order mail order videos or books and stuff. So, you know, I later realized I was kind of producing our music as the lead singer and songwriter in our band very poorly and uninformed fashion. But we had a management team and we had made three records on our own. And going when we were preparing to do our last record, our manager said, hey, you guys should consider using a producer for this record. And we're like, cool, what's that? You know, like, what does that mean? And who are we talking about? There was a guy in Atlanta who was kind of doing some good sounding stuff. His name's Rick Beato. And there were several producers on the list. And the deciding factor for that, which I talk to bands and artists about this all the time, the thing that moved the needle for me was, you know, we met with a bunch of producers and listened to their stuff. And then Rick sent us a CD of 10 songs that he had produced. And there were 10 artists on this CD. We had never heard of one of them. But every single track sounded like it should go on the radio. And we're thinking, why have we not heard of these guys? And they sound like they should go on the radio. We've toured every haunt in the United States or in this side of the United States, and we've never heard of any of these people. So that was a significant piece of it. And then I had a buddy who had recorded the same song, one with another producer and then one with Rick Beato, and he played them for me, and it was, you know, the difference, it wasn't even comparable.
Yeah.
So that's what started my my understanding of what producing was. It also coincided with the first time I ever saw audio in Pro Tools. So the first time I ever saw Pro Tools and the fact that I could see the acoustic guitar waveform or that fascinated me and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, we were touring doing 200 and, you know, I did 236 shows the last year I toured.
God.
So that doesn't, yeah. I mean, we were serious, but we were quickly approaching burnout. And this was a new shot in the arm. Like, wow, this is producing is crazy. And I became good friends with Rick. And I knew how much I was paying him. And I was thinking, good gosh, I could do this, I think, you know, and I could learn from him. And that's part of what made me move to Atlanta from Mississippi at the time. And, you know, Rick was basically my mentor for many years. He still is in a lot of ways.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I just started begging him to sit around the studio, and I'll sweep the floors. I'll take out the trash. I'll go get coffee. I'll play guitar on some stuff if you want, whatever, you know. And that's what led to me becoming a producer. Our band kind of fizzled out, and that's how it all started.
Yeah. Were there, so I was a liner note guy. Like I read every, you know, my parents bought me through the first piece of music I ever bought with my own money. My older brother and I split it and we bought Run DMC Raising Hell on cassette. And then my parents got me Thriller on vinyl for my fifth birthday. And I literally still have that copy of Thriller like over my vinyl collection.
I remember
reading like, this guy played, I didn't even know, you know, as a kid, I didn't even know what a bass guitar was when I was 6 or 7 years old. You know, I was like, this guy, I don't know the difference between that and that. You know, I'm just watching the video. MTV had just become a thing, you know, when I was about that age. And I just remember watching all that. And I was intrigued. I just didn't know what anybody did. It just fascinated me that it took this many people to make Thriller. I mean, I knew like later, you know, you find out like Quincy's the man, but there was like, you know, it was 30 people that played on that record. You know, there's a whole Instagram account that's like built it's really around like breaking down the Thriller tracks, and that's all they do on this Instagram account, and it's fascinating to me. And I don't even really love that album. I mean, I love it, but yeah, I'll message it to you. But as Nick Kirk may have shared it with me, but yeah, I got fascinated.
By the way, we could do an entire podcast just talking about Nick Kirk.
Yes. Yeah, we could. He would love this. Yeah, he would love this. When we just finished working on a little film project together that he so graciously asked me to work with him on. And so that was a big, big honor and super fun.
Awesome.
But yeah, like, man, I don't know. Then when I did find out, though, there were records that I'm like, I'm intentionally listening to this after I learned what production was. What were the records that you remember, like after you were conscious, you've been hanging out with Rick, y'all make these records, you're watching him work day in and day out, and now you're conscious of it. What were the records that you went, oh my gosh, that's incredible production. That's incredible production. And started to kind of catalog, because you, like we started this conversation talking about like you've definitely worked across tons of genres, super well, but you kind of form a thing, you know, that you do. Those early records that started to form that Dan Hannon like approach to record making, what were some of those records?
Well, part of it honestly was a re-education about music and genres, because I had sort of, you know, as an artist, I was very, I was trained in music on drums, and I had sort of a haughty idea of myself as a musician and what I knew about music. And I liked things that had musical merit. You know, I didn't get the aesthetic piece as well, because I was focused on, you know, compositions type stuff. Like I was a jazz drummer. So a lot through college, I listened to Sting and the Police and Peter Gabriel and stuff that was a little bit headier, I guess you could say. And again, I know I was a bonehead. I'm not saying that I knew anything more than anybody else. But after experiencing record production and hearing Rick break down different albums that he loved and rock music, and I actually had to go back and start listening to Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Weezer and a bunch of big rock records of the 90s and start to understand how the aesthetic plays a role. And as haphazard as some of that stuff might sound, some of it's very well composed, you know, but
yeah,
not in the musical sense, like you're scoring music. And so it was a lot of it was re-education, but then it, just like you said, it became, now I'm going to listen to every record I ever hear with a complete different perspective. I'm listening for the sonic makeup and the way different parts are arranged. And Brendan O'Brien was certainly a big one. I mean, I started breaking down every record that he ever made. A lot of Rage Against the Machine, Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots. But I was also a pop guy, you know, just by nature. I loved pop music. And I mentioned I love the vocal. And I'm a sucker for a good song. And when you mentioned being able to cross multiple genres, honestly, that's kind of what I feel like what drives the effort is the song, because you can surround the right song with all kinds of different genre elements or genre specific elements, as long as you know how to get good tones and get good performances out of the musicians.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I answered the record question effectively, but I will say, one that I overlooked, Grace by Jeff Buckley was one of them that, as an artist and a producer, just wrecked me and made me question what I was doing with my life for a long time.
It did, like, that to a lot of people.
How could I ever call myself an artist when a man made a record like this? You know, it's like depression set in.
Yeah.
You know, rethinking my existence set in.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, probably too many to name, but the blessing and the curse is, I don't know that I can enjoy records. You know, there was a threshold that I crossed where now it's a critical exercise on listening to music more so than it is, man, I love this, you know, and
yeah.
I miss that sort of, they say ignorance is bliss, you know, and there was some bliss associated with not having any clue what people were doing to make those records sound the way they did. But
yeah, it does take a little bit of the magic away. There are still things that I will find that bring that back to me, like getting into different genres altogether that I've missed, you know, maybe in the last, I don't know, last 5 years, that period of like 81 to 84, like what pop music was, you know, in that era, like early Cure, you know, Cockatoo Twins, they were a little later, but like, you know, that era of synthwave stuff and things like, I didn't know a ton about that. So when I pull up, you know, I don't have like Prophets and Jupiters and all the hardware synths around my studio, but I have all these plugs. And so I had a day where I would pull those up and just, you know, and I know how a synth works, but I don't know those things. And it was really like, there's something refreshing and inspiring about feeling like a kid turning knobs, you know, on something a little bit again. And so there's been some ways that I've been able to find that, but there is a little bit of it when you're like, oh man, we have so many documentaries now and so many behind the scenes things. That like there's a, it's, I love it. And I'm like, y'all listen to all the podcasts on how Tom Petty made Wildflowers or how, you know, Butch Vig made Nevermind or whatever. Like I'll watch all those things. But then I'm kind of like, oh man, you know?
Yeah. We've pulled back the proverbial curtain.
Yeah. Curse of knowledge, man. for sure. Yeah. I'll ask you this to wrap up, dude. Did you watch the Grammys Sunday night?
I did not.
Full disclosure,
I haven't watched the Grammys in a long time.
In a long time. So you didn't see anything from it on social media or anything?
I didn't. Well, I saw a couple things that were important, which were not on the broadcast, but on Instagram, you know, just videos that were from there. And a group called Larkin Poe, I saw won a Grammy. And those are Rebecca and Megan Lovell, who I worked with years ago. So I'm super proud for them to have made it. I've watched them over a decade of doing music. I've recorded stuff with them, you know, years ago. So seeing that manifest for them was amazing. And Catherine Marks and Boy Genius.
Oh, yeah.
They were present there. I don't know if they won. They may have.
They won three, and Phoebe got an extra one, too. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know you worked with Julian Baker in the past at some point, right?
Yes, and so that was really awesome to see her doing so well. And Catherine Marks is also, who produced that stuff, is doing amazing things right now. Her career is on fire. And I believe that she is coming to the Manor with Manchester Orchestra in the spring.
Nice.
To do Manchester's next project. So we'll have our next Grammy winner here on the premises doing music. And but so anyway, I feel bad that I said that because I was on the board of governors for NARIS, for the Recording Academy, for two terms, which was 4 years in Atlanta. And I should be way more connected and focused on that. But, you know, life goes on, life happens. And
yeah, for sure. Things
fall out of your, you know, purview. But
yeah. Well, I was going to ask you what your favorite moment from it was, but you didn't see it. So now I'm going to ask you what your favorite project is that's coming out this year, like that you're working on, or not your favorite, but something that you're looking forward to. I know Band Lula's got stuff going on. I know Gary Nichols got stuff going on. Okay, Kennedy's got stuff going on. Y'all got other artists you're working with. What's something that's coming out everybody needs to know about?
Eli Hannon.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm very biased. I'm not remotely objective, except to say that Eli is a kid who grew up around making records. Yeah. So, which is something I think a lot of us wish we could have been around for, or that could have defined our upbringing. But, you know, as objectively as possible, I can say that he is, if not he's one of the most talented people that I've ever worked with. He's 19 years old. He's playing gigs all over the town. He's already become, if not the top keys session player in Muscle Shoals, he's one of the top two.
Yeah.
And he sits in with all the legends that are still here playing, and they just rave about him. Obviously, I'm proud. But he is making his debut record. And the stuff he's doing just is mind-boggling. It's amazing. Obviously, it's incredible to watch as his dad. But I almost can't take any credit for it because he's put in the work over all these years. He's really become a true artist. He's dedicated to the craft. He is certainly by no means surfing his dad's coattails.
Yeah.
So that's the one to look out for. Not only this year, but I think for the next decade, he will become an artist that is important, culturally speaking.
Yeah, I don't doubt it, man. The first time I ever heard him sing, I was like, oh my God. And you can hang around studios. 12,
right?
Yeah. He must have been like 13. I don't even think he was in high school yet or something. But like, you can be around record making all you want, but that doesn't give you a great voice. You know what I'm saying? And you can watch other people do the craft, but you got to put the hours in, and to be as good as he, you know, I follow him on social and see stuff on social media and stuff like that. And so I'm glad to know he's got a project coming out. And I'll link up some stuff to projects that are going on at Ivy Manor in all the show notes. So if you've been listening this whole time and you're going, I'd like to listen to Gary Nichols stuff or OK Kenny stuff, I'll link a bunch of that stuff in the show notes so people can come check it out. Dan, thanks so much for the time, bro.
Thank you, man. Thank you for inviting me to do this. It's an honor. And one real quick thing, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that all the artists you just named, OK Kennedy, Gary Nichols, the whole staff and crew and people around Ivy Manor have also poured so much into Eli. So that's also credit where credit is due. But thank you, Lee. I appreciate it, man. And I'd love to do this again anytime you want to, man. I enjoyed it.
You got it. You got it, man. Have a good one, Dan.
You too, buddy.
What a great conversation. That's super inspiring to talk to people who you admire, like Dan. Not just as a record producer, but just as a person. And great conversation. I hope you're as inspired and encouraged as I am. Make sure you follow Dan on Instagram. He's just at Dan Hannon. You can also get everything you want to know about Ivy Manor at ivymanormusic.com and follow their accounts, the studio accounts. They're always posting cool stuff about the projects they got going on as a music group and as a recording studio and all that. And if you're thinking about making, maybe you're a musician, you're listening to this, man, Muscle Shoals is iconic. If you don't know, you should go watch the Muscle Shoals documentary. It's just called Muscle Shoals. All these great things that were recorded there. Mustang Sally, I'll Take You There. The Rolling Stones, Wild Horses, and Brown Sugar. I mean, just all kinds of incredible things with the Swampers and Fame Studios. And it's iconic. But Dan mentioned in the episode, there's a whole new wave of inspiration and music and things happening in Muscle Shoals that's not nostalgic. As cool as that is, and as much history and unbelievable history as Muscle Shoals has, there's new stuff happening there. So if you want to work on a project, you should definitely do it at Ivy Manor at the Shoals. So ivymanormusic.com, go check that out. Make sure you follow us at MyFi Podcast. You can follow me as well at Lee T. Baker. You can go subscribe to MyFi Monday, which is the great newsletter that I do every week for creatives and creative leaders. Go to myfipodcast.com, scroll down. You can subscribe to MyFi Mondays. And until next time, you guys just have a great one.